Hi, and welcome from Holden Village. Today is June 23rd, the year 2000, and in the Creekside Room, Paul Olson conducts another session. Great Stories We Need to Know is the series, and this session will be Whose History, Who Decides What For Me? Today's session is, today's tape is OLP 2000-9. So let's join Paul now for session.
My name is Paul Olson, and this is a session entitled Great Stories You Ought to Know. And the reason I have titled it that is that all the literature that I've been teaching is from the African American community. And most of us at Holden this week, and frankly, most weeks, are white. And these stories are worth taking a look at. Richard Wright, the great novelist and sometimes poet, said about 40 years ago that the black writer is the one who can offer us the most about our society because he corrects the society from the outside. And when I first read that, I thought of, I like to think of myself anyway as kind of an environmentalist, and I don't want to be judged with my environmental work by an industrialist. I want to be judged by somebody on the inside, because it's easy, you know, they're not going to disagree with me. Well, that's what the white society has thought too. So, we'll start with this quote. James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time there says, everything white Americans think they believe in must now be re-examined. So what I thought I would do is look at some literature and convey some experiences through the literature. And I've got some drama here. We can take parts, and only two parts though. I look for one more. And we'll play some roles a little bit and kind of see where do we get our thoughts about society? Where do we get our values? And in an hour, we'll answer all those questions, and we'll know, and we'll have it all down with that. I thought. Here's a chair. I won't lose it.
There's one over here.
I've never sat down to teach in my life. Where's one by Dorothy? Where's the other one?
This one.
At Augusta Anna College, where I teach all the time and have for a long time, I teach different courses on African-American literature. I thought I would start after that quote with a poem that one of our students wrote in this class. And I looked for reasons to read this. The reason I read it is because I like it. I said, is there a way I can force this into fitting what we're trying to do? No. Yeah, there is. I've decided this. This is the kind of sensitivity that can happen if we begin to think about and re-examine the things that we believe in. The context of this assignment was, it was fun to assign poetry in just a literature class because everybody thinks that, especially non-majors, think it's poetry. I can't write poetry. And this was a business major that wrote this. But the context was this. We had, outside of class, they had been assigned to watch the documentary, Their Eyes on the Prize. Many of you have seen that. It's a wonderful documentary narrated by Julian Bond. And the context of the subject, pretty much, of the first video in that six-video series was about Emmett Till, the young Chicago boy who went south and said, bye, baby, to a white woman in a store. This is a 14-year-old kid. He's from Chicago. He's used to talking to white people. The year is 1954. He doesn't have a clue that a black boy should not be talking, especially baby, that kind of language, to a white woman in the south. He didn't know that. And later that same day, the husband of that woman and his brother came to the house where Emmett Till was staying, and he was staying with his uncle, the poet here calls him Grandpa, but it was really an uncle. He comes to Grandpa Mose, M-O-S-E's house, and says, is the boy here? Yes, they took him out, tied him to a, first they beat him to death, then they tied him to a fan, threw him in the river, and they found him a couple days later. The two men were put on trial and, of course, acquitted by an all-white jury. And you need to know those facts. And one other fact that you all remember, too. The movie E.T., the poet pulls that in. And you remember the E.T., the great scene in all the advertising that the kid is riding the bike? Or the kid's riding the bike and E.T.'s in the basket and they're going up to the moon?
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
All that's part of this poem. And this is, my argument is, that this is what can happen when we begin to re-examine. It's the kind of sensitivity that can occur. E.T. didn't get to ride in Eliot's basket past the moon. He floated down the Mississippi on his raft fashioned out of a cotton gin fan. He left swinging, beaten through the forest, and was sent home in a casket after the heinous experiments of two scientists, two manly walruses in clean white skins like Hitler's lab techies in Auschwitz. We all saw this creature they dragged from the water. The bloated superhuman face peered forth from the picture with protruding eyes and the ring that told us who he was. Identity can bring murder. And Grandpa Mose, like a late coming Eliot, pointed, and I didn't say this, in the trial, and that's also on the video when we see it, the prosecution asked Mose, Grandpa Mose, who had been hiding for weeks because they knew that he'd get killed if anybody found him, can you identify the people that came to your door last night? And he said, Mose stood up and said, "Dar he." So I'll back up a little bit. They pulled the body out. We all saw this creature they dragged from the water. The bloated superhuman face peered forth from the picture with protruding eyes and the ring that told us who he was. Identity can bring murder. And Grandpa Mose, like a late coming Eliot, pointed through the thickened courtroom saying, "Dar he, they the guys killed E.T. The men in white skins raised their scalpels to the threat of their smirking stable stances. He was an evil, most dangerous species. He said, bye, baby, to our white lady. He could have done fornicated with our kind. The Darhees ringing truth like a pistol shot, a pulpy pain, the final crack, 12 white cloaked men let the two go free." Just reactions. About sensitivity is what I guess I'm interested in your sensing. What did this kid, this white kid with a business major from Peoria, Illinois, know that he didn't know before? Because he began to re-examine what he believed in. Mm-hmm. Anything in that poem? Why are they so afraid? Oh, go ahead.
Judicial system.
The judicial system, for sure. Is it fair?
No.
How many of you wondered when the O.J. Simpson trial came out and the picture came, the picture in the folding, the fold-out in Time magazine was from Augustana College, where I teach, and they had this picture. It was all over the nation with the white kids going, the black kids going, yes.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Why?
Because they don't trust them, so they they've never trusted it. They kind of stand back and they look at us and they laugh. Look at all that.
Yeah, right. Were they 4A to O.J. Simpson?
Well,
no.
Sure.
No.
No.
Not personally.
Not personally.
For him to beat the system, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
We then, right after that happened, I had students go back and just do some very brief research. Go see if you can find as many as you can court cases where the black person was clearly innocent, the white people were clearly victims, guilty, and see how many times. Never. There wasn't a single case. And we probably had 250 cases, court cases documented throughout our library and throughout anybody's library that wants to look them up. So no wonder the black people cheered. Well, this young man in this poem becomes a little more sensitive to that. Okay, so what we're going to look at today through this literature is, where do we get these ideas about justice? How are they handed down? Who's right? Who's wrong? And I thought I'd start with three illustrations. The first one is a story that happened to me in my life that's not very important, and I'm just going to tell it and move on and let you decide what it says. My graduate school was the University of Oregon on the West Coast, and we had a lot of Polynesian students, Asian students, because we're on the West Coast, I guess. And there was a day every year in the summer when they celebrated Polynesian Days. And I was single at the time, ate in the cafeterias, and I remember going through the cafeteria on Polynesian Days, and strawberries and pineapple and banana, you know, all this great fruit. And then came the main staple, and it was poi. Well, I put a little poi on the plate, and I went and sat down by two classmates that I knew in class who were from the Polynesian Islands, and boy, they just gobbled up their poi, and I gobbled up my strawberries, and I took one taste of that stuff, and just kind of slightly just kept go back to the strawberries and kept eating it, and then later that night I went over to McDonald's and had a hamburger. End of the story. You will come back to it.
Yeah.
The second illustration is, I need two readers. I need a guy, they're both women parts, but I've never been that kind of teacher. I don't care who reads them. I need somebody that thinks they're a good reader. That's a terrible way to start. Oh, that's me, I'm a good reader. I need two readers. I know you're a good reader. I know you're a good reader. You've got stuff. Okay, the setting for this is from James Baldwin's Amen Corner. It's a wonderful play, and if you have, it's kind of unfamiliar, I think, in a lot of literature circles, but if you've read his novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, that's a little more familiar, kind of the same kind of themes. Anyway, the Amen Corner, you can guess from the title, is about how people hide in religion. And they'll hide, and they'll bring their, and they'll take all their values from this handed-down religion without ever thinking about any of them. And the scene here is Margaret is Sister Margaret, and she's the head of the black church in this play. And Mrs. Jackson comes to her, and Mrs. Jackson is having some problems. She wants to go to the Lord, but she's also got a husband who likes to pay a little bit of attention to him. And Margaret thinks that you've got to give everything to the Lord. Well, here we go. So, who's who?
Wait, some of us don't hear real well. Could you turn around?
That's a great idea. Yep, they'll turn around.
You're not in the back row.
Ginger says, I'm never coming to this class again.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so you guys start. Here's the setting. Music is heard off stage, a slow, quiet sound. The light comes up slowly. Margaret enters, and as she enters, Mrs. Jackson stirs. They stare at each other for a moment, and Mrs. Jackson is weeping.
Sister Margaret, you're a woman of the Lord. You say you use in communion with the Lord. Why he take my baby from me? Tell me why he do it. Why he make my baby suffer so? Tell me why he do it.
Sister, we got to trust God somehow. We got to bow our heads.
My head is bowed. My head been bowed since I was born. His daddy's head is bowed. The Lord ain't got no right to make a baby suffer so, just to make me bow my head.
Be careful what you say, daughter. Be careful what you say. We can't penetrate the mysteries of the Lord's will.
Why's I gotta be careful what I say? You think the Lord gonna do me something else? I ain't got to be careful what I say no more. I sit on the bench in the hospital all night long, me and my husband, and we waited and we prayed and we wept. I said, Lord, if you spare my baby, I won't ever take another drink. I won't do nothing to displease you. If only you give me back my baby, safe and well. He was just a nice baby, and just like his daddy, he liked to laugh already. But I ain't going to have no more. Such a nice baby. I don't see why he had to get all twisted up and curled up in pain and scream his little head off. Couldn't nobody help him. He hadn't never done nothing to nobody. Ain't nobody never done nothing bad enough to suffer like that baby suffered.
Daughter, pray with me. Come, pray with me.
I've been trying to pray. Every time I kneel down, I see my baby again, and I can't pray. I can't get it out of my head. It ain't right. Even if he's God, it ain't right.
Sister, once I lost a baby too. I know what that emptiness feels like. I declare to my Savior, I do. That was when I come to the Lord. I wouldn't come before. Maybe the Lord is working with you now. Open your heart and listen. Maybe out of all this sorrow, he's calling you to do his work.
I ain't like you, Sister Margaret. I don't want all this, all these people looking to me. I'm just a young woman. I don't want my man in my home and my I just want my man in my home and my children.
But that's all I wanted. That's what I wanted. Sometimes what we want and what we ought to have ain't the same. Sometimes the Lord, he take away what we want and give us what we need.
And I do need the man sitting at home. And do I need the man sitting at home with a busted heart? Do I need two children in the graveyard?
I don't know. I ain't the Lord. I don't know what you need. You need to pray.
No, I'm going home to my husband. He's going to be getting worried. He don't know where I am.
Sister Jackson, why did you say you ain't going to have no more babies? You're still a very young woman.
I'm scared to go through it again. I can't go through it again.
That ain't right. That ain't right. You ought to have another baby. You ought to have another baby right away. Honey, is there anything you want me to do for you now in your time of trouble?
No, Sister Margaret, ain't nothing you can do.
Get on home to your husband. Go on home to your man.
Give him a hand. What a try. We'll come back to it. The third illustration is from Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And at the beginning of the book, you all know who Maya Angelou is. And she just has this paragraph. Wouldn't they be surprised one day I woke out of my black, ugly dream and my real hair, which was long and blonde, would take the place of the kinky mass that Mama wouldn't let me straighten? My light blue eyes are going to hypnotize them after all the things they said about my daddy must have been a Chinaman. I thought they meant made out of China like a cup, because my eyes were so small and squinty. Then they would understand why I had never picked up a southern accent or spoke the common slang, and why I had to be forced to eat pig's tails and snouts, because I was really white, and because a cruel fairy stepmother who was understandably jealous of my beauty had turned me into a too big Negro girl with nappy black hair, broad feet, and the space between her teeth that would hold a number two pencil. She's a wonderful writer. Okay, the third illustration, and we'll go. I got the Poi illustration, the Amen Corner, and the Dream. And now we're talking about values. And what do you, anything in common in those three illustrations? Or not in common? Anything you noticed in any one of them individually as well? Start here. My friends ate that stuff like it was strawberries.
Well, that's because they're used to it.
Food taste, yeah.
Brought up on it. Mm-hmm. I had to go get a hamburger.
That's, you're just not used to it. You get used to things. We're used to things. I mean, people eat lutefisk.
No.
Right?
No way. How many people eat lutefisk? I'd be so disappointed. My wife.
Okay. That's a boy lutefisk.
Okay, they're used to it. I'm not. And I'm going to push that a little further. So what?
You also can choose to go get something else, too.
Yeah.
You have the right, yeah. You can choose.
And I did. But I didn't choose to not like poi. I didn't choose that. I just didn't. And they, you know, and I don't know that I chose to like hamburgers more than poi, either. Did I?
No.
I mean, those of you who like lutefisk, did you choose it? I mean, in my family, grandma shoved it down your throat. So I think of that example, and I put my fingers on my taste buds and think, I'm not even free to choose what I eat, what I like to eat. That somehow that's handed down what I'm used to it culturally. Well, I'll run with that a while. Go to this one, the Amen Corner. There, what I'm trying to start us with is there are lots of levels of things that we inherit, that we accept that come to us through our history. One of them might be just our tastes in food, and that's not such a big deal. But it gets to be a bigger deal, I think, what we accept naturally in the Amen Corner.
Well, that's fatalism. I mean, there's one woman saying, why me? And the other one saying, you just have to accept it. You just have to accept it. And the other one saying, I don't want to accept it. And the other one's saying, you just have to accept it.
Okay.
That's
so that somehow handed down through this woman, through her beliefs in the church, is that this is a whole philosophy of life, is of one of fatalism. Anything else? I'll read some lines to you again, and just see what you do with them. I ain't got to be careful what I say no more. I sit on the bench, this is Mrs. Jackson. I sit on the bench in the hospital all night long, me and my husband, and we waited and we prayed and we wept. And I said, Lord, if you spare my baby, I won't never take another drink. I won't do nothing to displease you. If you only give back my baby safe and well. What do you do with that?
Is God like a white man? Is God like somebody you bargain with?
Well, white or not, that's a good point, that you can bargain.
Being punished for things that you do?
Yeah, I'll put it this way. That was Job's big hang-up, I think. If I do, then this will happen. And so my question for all of us then is, and here's what Baldwin gets at us, and so it's not just evaluate whether you like hamburgers or poi, that's a start. But where do we get this notion that if I, then this will happen? And then after a while, fatalism, if it does step in this play, if I, and then this happens, and then if I doesn't have any relationship at all to the effect. You know, I studied really hard, and I still got a C. I really worked hard. I ran 400 quarters that week. That might be why. And I didn't race very well. I mean, I did all the right stuff, and the effect didn't come out.
But in each case, we've been told, of course, that this is good or that you watch what you say, or that, you know, we've either been told by our authority figures or by our peers. Whether it's true or not, obviously.
So, in one level, we've just said food, I'll broaden that.
Tastes,
and it can be more than food. Here we've got, you know, a philosophical outlook, and we accept that this is the truth. This is how the universe works. David.
Yeah, in the amen corner, I hear somebody's suffering being explained away, marginalized, and explained away by a better way of thinking than the normal way of thinking.
Oh, great observation.
It's kind of a way to kind of smooth away those things that are going to happen in the black world, you know. That's the way it's going to be. Yeah. You just got to take it on, do it.
Good.
Do you think media has something to do with this, too? I mean, when you think about the food thing, the advertising, the philosophical difference in the second one, you know, what do we see in movies? What do we see just the values that are shown on TV?
I think it does. And we'll go for some more examples, but I love that it come from you as well as from this literature that we can all guess at the role of media for sure.
Yeah.
Anything else there? Go to this one.
Ideal of beauty.
Sure.
There's the media.
Yeah.
And
what's the ideal?
Not just beauty, but worth.
Yeah, worth. That's bigger. That's bigger than beauty. Right? Mm-hmm. Now my whole self-worth is affected by it. It's been told to me.
But yeah, well, there's a physical ideal. She wants to be like Barbie. I mean, she wants to be blonde-haired and blue-eyed and everything.
So beyond the physical ideal, then what do we have? I mean, you've got it. Self-worth. And then what's the significance of that? My point is, the point of the question is, how deep does this go of what we accept that just comes down historically, passed on to us? I mean, somehow in history we get these values passed on. We get them philosophically, our tastes. This could be our tastes about beauty. Anything else you see in this illustration? Yeah.
Well, it's a sense that if I was like that, everything would be okay.
Yeah. So all of these ideas begin to overlap, don't they? And connect. And it becomes so complicated that no wonder Baldwin says, everything white Americans think they believe in must now be re-examined. Elsewhere in a different, not by Baldwin, Lerone Bennett, the black sociologist at the University of Chicago, suggests that the society as it's structured now cannot possibly correct the mistakes that have been handed down through history. The society as it's constructed, shaped now, can't do it. So we'll come to, I hope, some looks at some parts. That's a big, big word, the society. And eventually, I've got some more illustrations from the literature. We can look at maybe a couple of the institutions in our society, maybe most especially for us, our church, our schools. How are they structured that we can't correct some things that are out there? We'll look at that. But we're on to this, and I'll share some more with you as we go. I've got some language ideas. What's the difference between, I'll put it on the board, saying when we refer to groups of people, the words I've written up there are people of color and non-white.
One's a negative.
Focus.
Focus. And what's the focus here?
Non-white. It's not part of the group.
And white is
white.
Is normal.
White is the group.
That's
white
the norm.
The focus.
And white's the focus, yeah. People of color, switch the focus. And so our language, and we inherit that too, and we can go without. You got any more ideas?
Black
the way
and white.
We look at people. Pardon me?
Black and white. I mean, when we say things are right or wrong, they're either black or white.
Yeah. Good. Language. And we use language, we accept it without much thought. And then here's Baldwin, let's re-examine everything, our language too. Baldwin has, in this wonderful essay, it's an essay, The Fire Next Time, listen to what he says to us, following Richard Wright's notion that the black writer is the corrector. Life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun inexorably rises and sets, And one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives, will imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have. You can get into his religious beliefs if you want to, but I'm interested right now or I'm asking you to be interested in his social response. The whole root of our trouble is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives and imprison ourselves in, look at his words, in totems, or some others that you remember?
Mosques.
Steeples.
Taboos.
I'm going to ask you to illustrate these concretely in a second. Taboos, races, armies,
nations.
Flags.
What?
Flags.
The flag, you know, you all read about it. It's a big deal and where they're going to fly the Confederate flag. Okay. Some examples of that.
The totem is a family history.
Okay. Perhaps the sun will, pardon me, we sacrifice beauty and imprison ourselves in...
Thomas Jefferson and Sally Henry, a family history?
Keep going, I don't get it.
Well, they don't want to admit, I mean, it's just on PBS, I mean, the white people are not willing to admit that the black people are part of their family history.
Oh, I see.
You see?
Okay.
So they've got a family history, they've got a story. Thomas Jefferson,
okay.
This is their
Anybody
story.
Anybody else? Good, good. More, another one. Flags, nations. How many, has anybody here yet read Desmond Tutu's book, No Future Without Forgiveness? It's got to be on your list, okay? It's a whole new concept of how to look at victimization. And it has to do with not hiding behind flags and not hiding behind nations. This is our nation, this is our flag. We're going to get past that now. We're going to.
The identity of the nation or the symbol becomes greater than what the beauty is.
Yeah.
It kind of loses.
Yeah. Can we name places like that? Just look across the world and think of all the places that there are conflicts. And again, listen to Baldwin. We sacrifice the beauty of our lives. Who misses out on the beauty in the Middle East?
Israel.
Talk to Rabbi Marx. He's been in Israel a lot. What does he say about Palestinians and Israelis?
They hide behind their flag.
They do. And they miss out, the sacrifice, the beauty. Hutus in Africa.
Oh. The Tutsis.
Blacks, Tutsis.
Indonesia.
Oh,
yeah. Well, here's Baldwin. Everything white Americans think they believe in must now be re-examined. His notion is, well, I got some illustrations that are a little more fun than just an essay. Here is from this wonderful novel, Their Eyes Are Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. This is in the bookstore, by the way. You get a 1% discount if you buy it tonight. Bookstore's closed, isn't it? I'd really be in trouble. The story begins with this young, beautiful woman named Janie Starks, and she has been through three marriages, and the first two are very unsatisfying, and it's a rise to consciousness for her, and it's a rise to women's rights for her in these two very confining marriages, and she finally gets in a satisfying marriage, and I don't want to tell you what happens there, but she ends up coming home, back to the town that she left, and when she left with some money, and with a guy that's about 10 years younger than she. And she comes back, and what I'm after still is, how we stereotype and we accept these things, and then we accept these stereotypes that just come down to us. Well, you'll get it. She's walking through town, and the people all saw her come because it was sundown. The sun was gone, but he had left his footprints in the sky. A little metaphor that the sunset, okay. It was the time for sitting on porches beside the road. It was the time to hear things and talk. These sinners had been tongueless, earless, eyeless conveniences all day long. Mules and other brutes had occupied their skins. But now the sun and the boss man were gone, so the skins of these people felt powerful and human. They became lords of sounds and lesser things. They passed nations through their mouths. They sat in judgment. And along comes Janie. Seeing the woman as she was made them remember the envy they had stored up from other times. So they chewed up the back parts of their minds and swallowed with relish. They made burning statements with questions and killing tools out of laughs. It was mass cruelty, a mood come alive. Words walking without masters, walking along together like harmony in a song. What's she doing coming back here in them overalls? Can't she find no dress to put on? Where's that blue satin dress she left here in? Where all that money her husband took and died and left her? That's her second husband. She went off with her third. Back to that one. Where all that money her husband took and died and left her? What that old 40-year-old woman do? Doesn't that hurt? What that old 40-year-old woman doing with her hair swinging down her back like some young gal? Where she left that young lad off a boy she went off here with? Where'd she go? Thought she was going to marry him? Well, where'd he leave her? What he done with all her money? Bet you he off with some gal so young she ain't even got no hairs. Why, she don't stay in her class, meaning Janie. When she got to where they were, she turned her face on the bander log and spoke. They scrambled a noisy good evening and left their mouths setting open and their ears full of hope. Her speech was pleasant enough, but she kept on walking straight on to her gate, and the porch couldn't talk for looking. The men noticed her firm buttocks, like she had grapefruits in her hip pockets. The great rope of black hair swinging to her waist and unraveling in the wind like a plume. Then her pugnacious breasts trying to bore holes in her shirt. They, the men, were saving with the mind what they had lost with the eye. The women took the faded shirt and muddy overalls and laid them away for remembrance. It was a weapon against her strength. And if it turned out of no significance, still it was a hope she might fall to their level someday. What do you make of that? And think of, and the questions are about stereotypes and then how they perceived her. It's a simple thing. Out of what did they base all their judgments on?
What she was wearing.
She's wearing. And what happened? What has obviously happened to her? She went off with this young guy, and he did what?
He dumped her.
Okay. He took her money, and now she's coming home
wearing what?
With nothing. Wearing overalls. Where's that blue satin dress she had?
Yeah.
Well, none of that's the truth. The book's in the bookstore if you want to find out what really happened. it's real clear to us, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the kind of stereotypes they make. And so, who handed that all down? And what makes them jump on that without balling again? And not just white Americans, but re-examine what you believe in. I see this, therefore this must be the situation. That gets to be a pretty big deal in Richard Wright's Native Son. Native Son, the story is a young black boy ends up killing the daughter of the family for whom he works. He kills her by accident. He's caught in her bedroom. She's drunk. He carries her up to her bedroom, puts her down, and then in comes the mother, who's blind, so she can't. She just hears these noises. But if he gets caught, this black boy, in her bedroom, that's bad news, as you know. Emmett Till just showed us that. And he knows that, too. So she starts to moan and groan because she's so drunk. He puts a pillow over her face and accidentally kills her. Then he ends up cutting her up in pieces because he's so afraid. He puts her in the furnace, tries to hide her, and the plot thickens with all his fears. In fact, the title of the first book in the novel is called Fear, and fear precipitates every movie he makes. He is so afraid of what he can get blamed for. Not only was he up in the room, but of course, since he was up there, he must have raped her and done fornicate with her, like the kid said in the poem. Well, he gets caught, and he goes on trial, and his defense attorney has some interesting things to say about our justice system, but about our society as a whole. And again, we're going to ask the question, how do things get handed down? What do we accept? If only 10 or 20 Negroes had been put into slavery, we could call it injustice, says his defense attorney. But there were hundreds of thousands of them throughout the country. If the state of affairs had lasted for 2 or 3 years, we could say that it was unjust. But it lasted for more than 200 years. Injustice, which lasts for 3 long centuries and which exists among millions of people over thousands of square miles of territory, is injustice no longer. It is an accomplished fact of life. Men adjust themselves to their land. They create their own laws of being, their notions of right and wrong. A common way of learning a living gives them, of earning a living gives them a common attitude toward life. Even their speech is colored and shaped by what they must undergo. Your Honor, injustice blots out one form of life, but another grows up in its place with its own rights, needs, and aspirations. What is happening here today is not injustice, but oppression, an attempt to throttle or stamp out a new form of life, and it is in this form of life that has grown up here in our midst that puzzles us, that expresses itself like a weed growing from under a stone in terms we call crime. Unless we grasp this problem in the light of this new reality, we cannot do more than salve our feelings of guilt and rage with more murder when a man living under such conditions commits an act which we call a crime. What do you make of the notion of once it's been here this long, it's an accomplished fact of life? We don't even call it unjust anymore.
Well, isn't that why the civil rights was such a big upheaval? I mean, for a lot of people, it's just the way things were.
Yeah. Baldwin in his Fire Next Time, when one's concept of reality is changed, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundations. Mm-hmm. We don't like that. We'll resist that. And we'll accept what comes on down to us. Well, the attorney goes on with some more, and we'll listen to... what the prosecution says, and we'll talk about justice, and this is considerably shorter. Your Honor, says the prosecution, wanting to give the death penalty to this young boy. Your Honor, I say that the law is holy, that it is the foundation of all our cherished values. It permits us to take for granted the sense of the worth of our persons and turn our energies to higher and nobler ends. Man stepped forward from the kingdom of the beast the moment he felt that he could think and feel in security, knowing that sacred law had taken the place of his gun and knife. I say that the law is holy because it makes us human. And woe to the men who, in misguided sympathy or fear, weaken the stout structure of the law. What do you make of that? The law is holy.
Can we talk about Texas? And the death penalty, and the fact that they're so upset about challenging that they don't even want to be challenged, and it hurts their pride.
An illustration? That's good. And
when you talked about the beauty disappearing, I mean, this is sometimes easier to find a kind of order that...
I'm using your words.
And law can be one of the taboos
and
totems.
Oh, great example. And all of Martin Luther King's work tells us that just commands us to do this. Don't ask if it's legal. Ask if it's moral. It's a whole other fundamental value to look at. And so, Sir Baldwin, you use that word nicely, pulling back the other essay. We sacrifice beauty to follow the law. The law is, but more than that. What do you hear there from this guy? The law is holy.
The past. Holy. What's the past?
Which what?
The word holy.
Yeah, it's holy. And then somewhere, I don't know where to put that. We have more. It's holy. It's
infallible.
It's infallible. That's part of the holiness, perhaps.
Godly.
It protects us.
And it protects us.
It keeps us in prison.
There's a key.
This is very similar to the kinds of things you can read in a lot of the colonial chronicles in, like, India from the British government, and even in the U.S. Indian Affairs chronicles from the 19th century. You have opinions of commissioners or magistrates about the effect of bringing the law to this untamed place.
Yeah,
yes.
Good.
colonialism.
Yes. The idea that we have the word and we can impose it.
Well,
and it's something that's imposed on us.
So we've got, it's holy, it's God, it's absolute. Let's run then with the prosecution or the defense one more time and see how black writers, all writers can, I think black writers do it differently. That is, be correctives for us and force us to re-examine what we believe. The defense attorney says this in just a very short paragraph. Your Honor, I ask in the name of all we are and believe that you spare this boy's life. With every atom of my being, I beg this in order that not only may this black boy live, but that we ourselves may not die.
What's he mean?
We ourselves save him. Now the law says, I mean, he's been found guilty. He didn't do it. I mean, it was an accident. If anything, it was manslaughter. Okay. And well, she's dead, so it was manslaughter. But he's not guilty of first-degree murder, which is going to give him the death penalty, but that's what they sentenced to. He's going to die, and now he says he wants a different sentencing and says, save him, not only so this boy might live, so that we won't die. And the clue is to look at all of this stuff that law was. Let your mind run a little bit. How are we going to die if they kill him? What's that got to do with it? Huh?
Morally?
And what? I heard something over here, but I don't know where it was.
It's a consequence of punishing. We have to take responsibility for his being murdered. I mean, in the same sense. That's what he's saying, I think. Is that if he dies, then we are killing him, and we're doing the same thing that he's...
Yeah.
We're accusing him of doing.
Pushes it out of the realm of injustice into a thing that we just expect and accept, so that there's no evaluation of our actions at all. He had it coming to him.
Yeah, so one kind of justice, here we are with Tutu's book, is revenge. That's what we're going to do. I mean, the death penalty is revenge, right? This guy, we're going to kill him, period. But we don't die. So what's he after?
Well, I don't know what he's after, but, you know, I know that we're a whole... And I know for myself, when I lose connection with people who are opposite of me, I can feel something in myself dying.
Yeah.
Whether that's someone who's in great poverty, someone of another race, whatever it is, when those pieces are lacking in my life, something inside of me shrivels up.
It's a great assessment. It's wonderful reading. Bigger is part of us. We are all part of this, and that's a legitimate and good, healthy, wonderful reading. And I think there are other things too. I love it. I'm gonna put it in my notes for the next time.
Justice in that sense separates people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I think that's one of the
justice things. Justice equals separation.
That's one of the things Tutu is after. There.
Yeah. Tutu's words for it are justice of reconciliation and the justice of revenge. Revenge is what most of us want. Still, how are we, now tie it within all that Baldwin has, let their mind go back to Baldwin about beauty, we sacrifice, we somehow aren't fully alive because we've hidden behind races and flags and totems and races meaning black race, white race.
We've made these things our gods, and if those are what we're using to judge other people, it's the same that we'll be judged by.
And as we made those our gods, and we are judged by their, are we truly living? Are we living the truth? Are we, another way to look at your wonderful assessment, we're dead. We're not fully living, says Baldwin, when we hide behind these things. We sacrifice, his wonderful phrase, all the beauty in our life is sacrificed to meet this.
One could say that Jesus stepped out from his totems, out from his death, and became alive.
It's a fun idea. What totems did Jesus step out of? Rattle them off. Hundreds.
Rattle them off, beggars, prostitutes.
So he hung out with all the wrong people. What else did he do that just...
Broke the Sabbath laws.
Broke the Sabbath laws and explains, hey...
Challenge the authority.
Challenge the authority all the time. And Richard Wright, I think, through the voice of his defense attorney, is telling us, when you live that way, you're not fully alive. Sell all you have. Listen to all those radical things. Sell all you have. Love me more than your mother and your brother. I love the phrase, sell all you have. Whenever I think about that, I really do, a lot.
And a lot now.
Even my boat. It's not dangerous.
It doesn't say that in the Bible.
It doesn't say that. It doesn't
say the boat.
That's a bad one. I've gone to rabbis and pastors, anybody interpret this differently, and finally I get it from my doctor. Keep your boat. Good job.
He also has a boat.
Well, there's...
How often do Lutherans, does the Lutheran church, and maybe all churches, but especially Lutherans, use that phrase for decency and order's sake? You know, prevent us from change for decency and order's sake.
Yeah. That's a lot like the governors in the South said in the Civil Rights Movement, so, you know, that's law and order. run with this for a little bit, and you pick the one you want to, we might don't have time to do both of them. Everything we believe in, what are some things that are just handed down to us? And I'll give you, just to get you started, I'll give you some categories. Worship, music, and pastors. What are some things that we just say, this is the way it's done? And we will accept that, we're not going to question it.
Go to school, go to church on Sundays.
Okay, so we worship on Sundays. And, you know, the Norwegians in Onamia, Minnesota, so when they go on to stick in a Saturday one, oh, they passed out. what else about worship?
Pastors have to be heterosexual.
Ooh, that goes over here. Heterosexual.
Male.
Male
and heterosexual.
Yeah, bet.
They have to be able, I mean, we don't hire them unless we have certain things. You have to be able to preach, you have to be able to counsel. And, you know, you're a terrible preacher, but boy, what a counselor, what a teacher. No, we don't want you. I mean, all kind of music, I mean, you can think of this stuff.
Organ,
yeah, oh.
Do you remember when
guitar?
Music came out?
And what kind?
Well, it was in the, well, when I was, the early 70s and folk music came out, boy, it was a big fuss.
Yeah, we can't have that in church. Okay.
They definitely married to the organ.
What?
They need to be married to an organist.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
They do get part of it.
Well, it is.
And they can't be greedy and get put out.
The poor male pastor looking for a partner had to go around, you play the organ? You play the organ? I can't take you out, but anyway. Yeah. Well, listen to a poem from Leroy Jones, one of the radical American poets. This is called A Poem for Half-White College Students. And it's pretty radical stuff. I don't know if it's great poetry. But even that, our standards of judging poetry. In fact, I did this before. I'm going to do it again. I'll read you a poem that, what would Wordsworth say about this one, Dave? This is a poem. And we're accepting, those of us, you know, who make the study of literature our profession, we've had certain standards handed down to us, and poetry is, and we've got Coleridge's definition, and Wordsworth, we've got everybody's definition. Whose definition is this? This is a poem. before I read it, I better set it up for you. The Paris Peace Talks, 1968. What went on? What was the biggest issue?
Shape of the table.
Okay, here's the poem. This is how Don L. Lee would read it. I heard it. The Paris Peace Talks, 1968. Take that to your poetry class. Well, one thing that happens right away is that he's undone every idea we have of poetry.
Is that a petition?
Do we, huh? But we sure got the point, didn't we? That this is the kind of jump that went on. Well, people are death to all. In 6 months, how many people died? And while we're debating the size of the table. Well, I set that up, or used it as a setup for this poem, which isn't quite as radical in terms of the structure of a poem. But you'll get his comments about where do we get our values and how do we behave. And so this black poet is talking to black students in college. And apparently, in his mind, these black students have sold their soul. But I'm white, and I wonder, is he speaking to me? You'll hear. Who are you? Listening to me, who are you? Listening to yourself. Are you white or black, or does that have anything to do with it? Can you pop your fingers to no music except those wild monkeys go on in your head? Can you jerk to no melody except finger poppers get it together when you turn from star checking to checking yourself? That's a hard one to get, and that's all about drugs. And if you're on drugs, you know who you are. And that's one of the places, and he's critical of it, one of the places these young kids are getting their sense of self. But now the rest of them are easier to understand. The ghost you see in the mirror, is it really you? Can you swear you are not an imitation gray boy? Can you look right next to you in that chair and swear that the sister you have your hand on is not really so full of Elizabeth Taylor that Richard Burton is coming out of her ears? You may even have to be Richard with a white shirt and face and 4 million Negroes think you cute. You may have to be Elizabeth Taylor, old lady, if you want to sit up in your crazy spot dreaming about dresses and the sway of certain porter's hips. Check yourself. Learn who it is speaking. When you make some ultra-sophisticated point, check yourself. When you find yourself gesturing like Steve McQueen, check it out. Ask, in your black heart, who it is you are. And is that the image, black or white? You might be surprised right out the window whistling Dixie on the way in.
Wow.
What? In that poem, and then you can talk, all you white folks, us white folks, what's coming down to us?
When was that written?
I don't know the exact date, but I'm going to say 1964. That's close.
So it's near the Black Power Movement, right?
In the Black Power Movement.
So you have a defining line between black as power and everybody else.
For some of them.
For some of them, but...
Mm-hmm. Where are they coming from? What's the Steve McQueen stuff? Elizabeth Taylor, she's so full of, you know, Richard Burton's coming out of her ears.
Black students consuming the white media.
Good answer. Black students consuming the white media.
The ideal is us.
Once again, the ideal, it's us, yeah. The focus. Gray boy, imitation gray boy. What are the things that... Well, okay, the media, who hands all this stuff down that these, in this case, these kids are accepting? Well, I mean, what is it about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton? In the 60s, you guys are old enough to, some of you are, to remember what went on with those two. She was on the cover of Life magazine for one, besides being beautiful, in the standards that America has had, but something else put her on the cover. Anybody remember that?
Diamond.
Yep.
Diamond
ring. What was that?
The Hope Diamond.
Who said that?
The Hope.
Yeah. Well, remember what that was?
Her engagement ring.
Yeah. Was it an engagement ring? This 15 million pound thing that she put in a wheelbarrow and you know. But she's on the cover of Life magazine for that. So we're talking about the kind of beauty. What else
values.
Are we talking about? Values.
Well.
What does it take to get on the cover of Life magazine?
Money.
Money.
Yeah. And then what's the Steve McQueen gesturing like Steve McQueen? I mean, I don't know. You know, you just heard the poem, right? And your guess is as good as mine. But what comes to your... I love this phrase. It's been mine and teaching all the time. That's why I love it. Literature, literary criticism starts in the guts. It'll get to our head. We'll take it there. But it starts here. We're struck. Boom. So just don't think, you know, about it. Steve McQueen, what's he got to do with any of this?
Macho man.
Macho. Yeah.
Motorcycles.
Motorcycles. Oh. The Great Escape, the great movie.
Yeah, fighting against the world.
Sure, taking on the world. And who are you when you gesture like Steve McQueen? One of the fundamental values, that I have lots of poetry here I could pull out, there's not time, that the black revolutionary poets bring to us is, folks, everything that you believe in must be re-examined, and the black revolutionary poets tell us, and your fundamental basis for relationships is love. Your fundamental value is love. One poem starts out, poems are bullshit. That's right. I saw people go like that. My mother went like that too when I read it. Because poems that are talking about Revolutionary War and about fighting back, the poem continues and goes further and further and further. So stop all the poems. Don't write any until there's room in the world for love. The poem does that. The point is, those poets are beginning, in their radicalness, are re-examining everything that they believe. So, in the last couple minutes, any institution you want to look at, here's Lerone Bennett. The social system as organized is incapable of solving through normal channels the urgent problems presented to it by history. As organized. Look at we're all here because we believe one way or another in the work of the church. And Bennett says, the social system as organized is incapable of solving through normal channels. And then you guys raised some problems I wrote down over here. So, wow.
Doesn't a Christian church, look at the Christian church, it's a gigantic church. It's got lines drawn between all these different groups. We're consistently drawing lines and bigger lines. There's bigger canyons between it.
So that's the structure, that's the social system as organized, all these different denominations.
But that's a problem for the church. That's exactly why the church can't solve issues. That's a good thing for those who want to keep things the way they are, because it keeps the church divided.
That's your point, right? Say that again, just the way you did. It's a good thing for the church.
It's a good thing for those whose vested interest is keeping the status quo, because it keeps the church divided and talking about our divisions and whether pastors can be gay or not.
And
instead of using not normal channels to change.
And so we maintain, and we'll fight to the death to maintain those normal channels. I'm going to take away your channel. This is not normal poetry. The channels will be changed.
Sounds like a Pentecost step sermon.
But Jesus Christ said the greatest of these is love.
And the black poets must have jumped on that idea, because
that's what he said.
They said too.
Faith, hope, and charity, the greatest of these is charity. So.
Anybody else? Anything? I see my time is... Okay, go ahead.
I was interested in that poem about kind of the sellout blacks going to college. And you could read a similar poem about white suburban youth listening to, gangster rap music today. It's amazing. That's who kind of consumes a lot of that. And it's all talking about, life in the ghetto, that kind of stuff that's really foreign to what they... to what they experience, and yet they all want to live that kind of life. They all want to wear the baggy pants. And it's almost kind of flip-flopped in a sense. That now a lot of youth from the media are wanting to get that, to have an identity or have kind of a culture of cool, sort of, that's different from the white.
Yeah, that's a great point. I have a poem to respond to that. It's a wonderful poem that you'll like. And it's about that. That is the kids or anybody buying into, I can find it quickly.
The ass is always
good. I'll see if I have time to do this. Yeah, I got 3 minutes. This is about that, and the vehicle is this black guy who takes on all of the African stuff, and that's cool. And I'm just making an analogous to your really good point that where do we take our values, and are we examining them at all? And here's, I've heard Don L. Lee read this, and this is sort of how he reads it. Super cool, ultra black, a tan purple head, a beautiful shade. He had a double natural that would put the sisters to shame. His dashikis were tailor-made, and his beads were imported seashells from some black country I never heard of. He was triple hip. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory and came express from the motherland. He would greet you in Swahili, say goodbye in Yoruba. Woo, Jim, he'd be so cool and intelligent. Cool is so cool, he was uncool, but other black dudes cool. Cool, ultra cool, was bop cool, icebox cool, so cool, cold cool, his wine didn't have to be cooled, him was air-conditioned cool. Cool, real cool, made me cool, now ain't that cool? Cool, so cool, him nicknamed Refrigerator. Listen to these kids, and listen to all that you said today. Cool, so cool, he didn't know. This is written in 1968. After Detroit, Newark, Chicago, Watts, we had to hit. Cool, super cool, real cool. That to be black is to be very hot.
Well, the this poet is not going to let them. Just take, be cool. Re-examine where you are. And of course, this is the revolution time and the civil rights time. Anybody else have anything? Thank you. Enjoy Vespers.